Your brain is encased in a sphere of bone. Like a 3-pound lump of jelly, it sits in a bath of fluid that helps to cushion it from sudden jarring when you move. But there's still plenty of opportunity for shaking the brain, which we call concussion. The brain can be injured when either the head, the body, or both undergo sudden acceleration, deceleration, or rotation. Concussions can cause loss of consciousness, but most times they don't. With time and rest, the brain can recover. But what if the injury is missed? Go Healthy for Good starts right now. I'm Dr. Nerida. Welcome to Go Healthy for Good. When professional football players started committing suicide as a result of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, from recurrent severe concussions, the world began to sit up and listen. CTE was only diagnosed at post-mortem, but now early symptoms can include memory loss, depression, confusion, and aggression. Iron Mike played in 4 Super Bowls during his 15-season career, and he entered the Hall of Fame. However, the rest of this story is not a pretty one. After retiring, Mike Webster lost most of his former cognitive capacity. He lived out his last years in a truck with broken windows, squirting glue on his rotting teeth, thinking he could glue them together, and knocking himself out with a taser gun to relieve intractable back pain. He died at 50 from heart disease, but at post-mortem, his brain told the whole story. Here's part of a documentary by ESPN.
Mike Webster was a Hall of Famer. And I thought even more of Mike Webster than that. I thought he was the best offensive lineman that's ever put on pads. A real stand-up guy who would do anything for you. And he had an incredible sense of humor. And I just remember his brain. You know, he was so smart. The way things ended up was just beyond tragic in my mind, because he was a great father, a kind guy, an incredible football player, and a really bright mind.
The manifestation of the symptoms came on so strong and so quickly. I mean, when we were in Kansas City, he was a different personality. Pittsburgh, he was showing the start of it. Kansas City, he was a different personality.
Everybody that plays football gets dinged here, there, and maybe multiple times without necessarily realizing how serious it can be. And the idea of accumulation of multiple small hits is a very important concept, because it's pretty clear, I think, that this is a significant potential source of serious problems like Mike eventually had. I mean, he was very pleasant, very charming, but didn't have the drive and direction and the decision-making ability, and this is what gets destroyed in this process of repetitive brain injury. He was pretty much at sea in an open boat unless somebody directed him. By the time I saw Mike Webster, I don't think he could have handled grade school. He just was so significantly impaired that he just would not have been able to get through or get anything out of it.
I snapped the ball and I was running down, and they had a really great kick returner named White Shoes Johnson. And I wouldn't have a prayer on this earth of ever touching the guy because of his athleticism, and you know, I was like this slow moving target. So I actually got close to him when someone ear-holed me, and the first thing that hit the floor of the Astrodome was my head. So I was out. And they pulled me off the field. I remember getting sick on myself, vomiting on my jersey. And I remember the doctor doing the finger with the eye. And then I just remember waiting to go back in with an oxygen mask on. And I think they stuck an ice bag on my head. You know, that was pretty much it. But and then I just went back in. I don't remember much of the game, and I had terrible headaches for a couple of days.
The NFL Pension Board in October of 1999 made a finding that Mike Webster was totally disabled as a result of football-related head injuries.
And footballers sustain a lot of concussions. Today we're going to talk about everyday concussions, how to recognize and treat them. We'll do some exercise together, hopefully without getting injured, and make a delicious and unusual dip. But first, the news. In the headlines today, MRI helpful with helmet hits, simple test on sidelines to detect concussion, and blood test shows promise in predicting recovery. High school football players who've never knowingly had a concussion can still have changes on MRI scans of their brain. An accelerometer device was fitted to the helmets of 45 members of a varsity football team to capture every hit at every practice and every game in a single season. The more total hits a player sustained, the more changes that were measured in their brain. Further research is needed as it's not yet known whether the changes are temporary or permanent and how they may affect brain function. A simple vision test given on the sidelines can help identify athletes who've suffered a concussion during a game. These are the preliminary findings of a recent study. Researchers found that the King-Davick test, or KD, was able to detect nearly 80% of concussions, and when combined with tests for balance and short-term memory, all cases were detected. The test is taken before the season to establish a baseline. Then, when needed during a game, test takers read a few rows of numbers as quickly and accurately as possible. If they're slower to finish than they were at baseline, then concussion is suspected. Swedish researchers are studying a new blood test for accuracy in detecting concussion. They're measuring a protein called total tau, or T-tau, which is released when the brain is injured. The amount of T-tau can diagnose a concussion and predict how long symptoms may last. The initial study was small, and further work is needed before this test could measure the first objective evidence for safe return to play. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's Health News. I want to introduce you to Anthony Duran, pediatric neuropsychologist and director of Headfirst Sports Injury and Concussion Care, and Dr. Stanford Coleman, a pediatrician who also works at Right Time Medical Care, where he too sees children with sports injury and concussion. I asked Dr. Duran how common concussion can be.
Concussions can occur to anyone across the lifespan. For high school students, the CDC releases numbers all the time. Usually in a typical football season, you're looking at 100,000 to 300,000 concussions, and 1 in 10 high school athletes will experience a concussion.
In each season?
In each season.
So if they're playing for several years, there's quite a high chance then.
That's why sports concussions are getting a lot of press nowadays.
Now, Dr. Coleman, the CDC is describing concussion as an epidemic. Why is it being called that?
Probably because we're becoming much more aware of it. When we think about concussion occurring in all age groups, it's probably being recognized more now because it's in the media more. More people are discussing it. It's more. It's happening more in sports. It's happening more in the elderly. So as a result, I think our awareness is raising the level of to an epidemic proportion.
Some numbers they're reporting are 1.7 to 3.8 million concussions a year. And if you ask different researchers and I survey different doctors, some are reporting that that's underreported probably by threefold to tenfold. And that's why they're throwing epidemic numbers around.
Wow. So threefold, that would be 10 million.
That would be 10 million. And that's just sports-related concussions, those numbers I gave.
Oh.
So when we think about the mechanism in terms of the brain being shaken based on a force, it's probably much, much higher. I mean, there are a lot of household injuries that occur, there are a lot of injuries that occur outside of the house that shake the brain and that create symptoms of concussion. So I think as we learn more, know more, we will find that it's occurring more.
Now, if it goes unrecognized, you're saying that, you know, probably only a third of them are recognized. If it's unrecognized and therefore not actively managed, is there a greater chance of long-term sequelae, and what might that be?
No, you're absolutely right. If it goes unrecognized, there can be symptoms of the concussion that can be attributed to other causes. And those particular patients can continue their activities, be at further risk for additional head injuries, additional concussions. There are post-concussion syndromes that occur. There is a second impact syndrome that might occur in some patients where a concussion is not diagnosed. So it's really very important to be diagnosed early.
And it's not uncommon for a football player, a lacrosse player, or a rugby player to be playing in a game. And they take a hit, and everybody's trying to do the right thing. You have athletic trainers there, you have doctors there, you have coaches there, and they just don't see the hit. It happens behind a crowd of people, and the players are trained to do what?
Play on.
Keep playing. So then they make the mistake that, hey, I'm momentarily dazed, did I really have a concussion? And they keep playing. And then they take another hit, and that's the hit that can really put them out. So it's when you get those back-to-back concussions that can really extend recovery time.
That's why awareness is so important. I mean, we all have to be aware of a hit and some of the consequences, and that there may be a concussion present. So that's part of what we need to do, is educate people and make them more aware.
After the break, we're making a delicious dip with a difference. But first, we're out for a breath of fresh air.
I love being around waterfalls. I guess it's because I'm away from the office, away from all that stress.
Yeah, it's partly that, but you know, it could be due to negative ions.
What? Negative ions around here? Get those things off of me. I don't need more negativity in my life.
You don't need to worry.
No.
They're just invisible molecules that are made by nature. You know, sunshine, trees, moving air, and bouncing water like this. You get gazillions of them in the mountains, by streams, by waterfalls, and in the ocean over the waves.
Oh, so are you saying that negative ions have a positive effect?
They sure do.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah. You know, there was a study done by Columbia University, and they found that a machine called a negative ion generator was as effective as an antidepressant for treating winter depression.
That's amazing. How can something so negative be so positive?
Ah, it's serotonin. That's the happy chemical in our brains. So much so that seasonal affective disorder scores improve by over 50%.
Wow, that's great. And air around waterfalls and mountains and ocean surf contain tens of thousands of them? Is that what you're saying?
Sure is. And you know, when air is ionized by lightning, many people feel like their mood is boosted after a thunderstorm.
Oh, that's me. I love going out after a thunderstorm and deep breathing, and I even love walking in the rain.
Ah, then you're a negative ion junkie without even knowing it.
I sure am.
You know, it increases the circulation to the brain, giving you mental alertness and vigor. That's why it's called a vitamin of the air.
So does air conditioning affect them?
Air conditioning depletes negative ions, so you feel drowsy. Also, the charged air molecules, they collect germs, dust, particles. So in air conditioning, you cough more and you're more likely to get sick.
So no wonder I feel so refreshed after I step outside, away from that air conditioning.
Sure it is.
So if bouncing water creates negative ions, every home has a built-in natural ionizer.
How so?
The shower.
Oh.
Maybe that's why I feel so good after a shower.
It's true. Circulation is stimulated by the water, and then your negative ions boost your energy.
So, are you telling me that I need more negativity in my life?
Not quite. Go outside. Walk in the forest. Get near the waterfall. And breathe deeply. Get plenty of mind-altering negative ions. Doctor's orders.
And we're back in the kitchen today, and I have Gail Voigt with me. Gail, welcome to Go Healthy.
Hi, Nerida. It's good to be back with you.
Now, what have you got for us today? What tasty treat?
Today we're doing beet and lentil hummus.
Wow. I'm imagining it already. That sounds wonderful. What's in it?
We start with half a cup of black beluga lentils, rinsed and soaked overnight. Then two medium beets peeled and cut into chunks. One clove of garlic peeled, two tablespoons of tahini paste, two tablespoons of cold pressed olive oil, two tablespoons of lemon juice, two teaspoons of grated lemon zest, and a teaspoon of sea salt.
Wow. So I'm going to lift the lid. This smells good.
Right. You want to take your lentils and soak them overnight, and then you're going to put them in a pot. Once you drain the soaking water off, put them in a pot with a cup of water and cut up your beets. You can peel your beets. Just cut them up into little inch-size pieces.
Wow. Ooh,
just
look
put
at the
them
color.
In together with the lentils, with a cup of water, and bring them to the boil. And then just simmer them until they're soft, they're cooked. About 15, 20 minutes.
All right. Now what?
Now we're going to put them into the blender. Right. If you go ahead and hold that for me, I'm going to scrape them in.
The colour is beautiful.
The colour is beautiful. You don't want to splash it on yourself.
Beets are so good for you. It's something that, especially if you're juicing, you don't want to overdo them. They're really powerful cleansers. They're known to be a blood cleanser, so really good.
And I would never have thought of putting beets in hummus.
Shall I make some zest for you?
You can do that. Until I went to a wedding in Australia just recently, and it was a picnic wedding. And the groom and bride made all the food themselves. He's a pastry chef.
Oh, really? I did all my own wedding food too.
Okay, so he prepared it
but
all.
I wasn't a chef.
And he tailored everyone's picnic basket to their preferences. And so mine had beet hummus, and it was so yummy. I knew I had to find a recipe.
Well, thanks for bringing it to us today.
You're welcome. You want to put some of that zest in here?
Yeah. That's probably about a couple of teaspoons, isn't it?
I'm sure it is. So go ahead and put it in.
What an amazing concoction this is. This is a great recipe.
Got a little more.
I don't want to waste it. It's just too good.
It is.
Oh, I love the smell.
Okay. Mm. We're going to just put the lid on here. And we're going to mix this. So just... All right, that looks good. There it is.
Beautiful.
Smells wonderful. And don't you love that colour?
It does. That smells great.
All right.
Well, you've made some already.
We've already put some out for you to taste.
Excellent. So I think I might have something like celery in mine.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to try the carrot stick. And it's good on crackers too, little crackers, veggie sticks.
Wow. That's great. That is hummus. That's really unusual and just... It's got a great flavour. Love that lemon. You want to try it? Thanks, Gail. Remember, you can see all of the recipes on our website. Now I want you to meet Tracy, who experienced what our experts mentioned, second impact syndrome. Listen up, because you don't want to miss this message from the CDC.
It was January 10, 2005. I was 17 years old, and my high school basketball team was playing a varsity game. And it was around the second quarter, and I was going up for a rebound. And as I came down, the back of my head collided with the top of another girl's head. The next day, after the day I got hit, I went to school, and I was really sick. I knew I had a concussion because I suffered through a concussion my seventh grade year. I had all the symptoms, dizzy, nauseous. I couldn't focus in school. I continued to play a second game after that, and I passed out after the second game in the locker room. Basically, I was bedridden in my house for about 6 months straight. I slept on the couch because of the light. We had to put dark sheets over the windows. My mom and my sister had to help me walk around. I lost my balance. I couldn't really get that back for quite a while. I didn't know it could get this bad. All athletes have a strong will, and since we're young, we know that we have to suck it up, suck things up, whether, you know, you sprain your ankle or you hurt your finger, you just go in the game and you shake it off and you don't complain, you don't cry. But this is a brain and head we're talking about, and you can't suck it up. So unfortunately, instead of missing a game, I missed the season. I miss sports for the rest of my life, and I miss out on a great life that I could have had. Athletes need to know, if you think you have a concussion, don't hide it, report it. It's better to miss one game than the entire season.
One game versus a whole season, or as turned out for Tracy, it cost her whole career. Yet a bump on the head can seem so minor. I asked Dr. Coleman to explain why mild head trauma alters brain function so dramatically.
Well, it's actually a biomechanical, biochemical injury to the brain. And so it's like a metabolic disorder. It's not something that you really see in the brain when you look at it in terms of an injury or a bruise, but it's a change in the metabolic function of the brain. And that's based on a change in the chemical reactions among the cells that are carrying electrical impulses throughout the brain. So it's really not a gross damage to the brain, but it's a more of a biochemical metabolic disorder.
So not something that you can sort of see and touch.
That's correct.
So give us a little glimpse into what's happening there. When you say biochemical or metabolic, what's actually happening there?
Going into a little bit more detail?
Yeah, a little bit more detail.
Okay, in the areas where the brain actually hits the skull, there's stretching and twisting of the cells, and the neurons really don't like that. And the neurochemicals that are inside the cell now get thrown outside the cell, and the neurochemicals outside the cell now get thrown inside the cell. And the important thing to remember, not so much the chemicals, and we could go into that if you want to, but the important thing to remember there, as Dr. Coleman mentioned, is that the brain cells are not functioning optimally, and that's why you're going to get the symptoms you have.
So the impulses that are usually being transmitted are not being transmitted properly. So as a result, the thinking activities of the patient, the physical activity of the patient is disrupted based on the biochemical change.
Because neurons, when we think of cells normally in the body, they're tiny things, but nerve cells are quite different, aren't they? They have long axons and they interrelate with each other by chemistry rather than by physical structure.
Correct.
So, that's it, exactly. Okay.
So tell us, say a bystander on, let's say it's a car accident, or not necessarily on the sports field. Let's start thinking about other scenarios. What would a bystander see?
Well, they may not see anything that's really obvious that will say specifically that this person is undergoing a concussion, but that patient may undergo a change in their mental status, change in consciousness. If it's very serious, they may have a seizure. So there are a number of ways that a concussion can be manifest initially when it occurs. But a lot of the symptoms are more long-term. It's not necessarily the immediate symptoms that we see. Obviously, in a motor vehicle accident, you can have more serious damage to the brain where there's actually tearing of the tissues and bleeding into the brain and increased pressure within the skull. But for concussion, with it being more of a metabolic disorder, some of the symptoms are more subtle and that we see over time.
So what might the person actually having the concussion feel or sense?
Probably the most common symptom is after they have a head injury, is they're going to experience a headache, general fatigue. They might experience nausea. They'll experience symptoms in four different areas: physical, emotional, cognitive, and sleep. Some of the other physical symptoms might be difficulties with balance. Some of the cognitive symptoms might be trouble with attention, concentration, memory. Some of the emotional symptoms might be irritability, sadness, anxiety, feeling more emotional. And then the final category, sleep, having trouble initiating sleep, feeling drowsy, sleeping too much, sleeping too little. And those are the different areas that somebody's going to experience after they have the concussion. Most common is going to be the headache and the dizziness and the nausea. And then, as Dr. Coleman mentioned, those other symptoms generally tend to settle in as the injury kind of manifests itself. It's not uncommon for a third of patients that we see 48 hours to 72 hours later, their symptoms are much worse. They're thinking, the head injury's not that bad. And we really try to educate them. You really need to go back to the doctor. You really need to be seen. These symptoms can get worse, and oftentimes they do.
So as you see, some of these symptoms are pretty nonspecific. I mean, there are other clinical entities that can produce some of these same changes in someone's behavior and how they feel. And that's why it's important for health professionals to really get a good story of the mechanism of injury for a head injury that might produce a concussion, do a good physical examination, a good neurologic examination, and collecting a lot of information that we put together to actually make the diagnosis of concussion.
So what's the acute evaluation? Is that a good history, the good physical, neurological, and really documenting the story?
Absolutely. The story is critical. I mean, just as Dr. Dorn mentioned about the acceleration, deceleration, and the rotational forces, we really have to have a good understanding of the mechanism of injury first. That really gets us started understanding what kind of injury or damage might have occurred to the brain.
And you can analyze the forces.
And we can analyze the forces, how bad the force is, when it occurred. And so then that gives us a good start. Then we ask questions about how the patient is feeling at that point and evaluating the physical and emotional and balance issues that the patient may be having at that particular point in time.
Since you can't, as Dr. Coleman mentioned, you can't see a concussion on a CT or an MRI, we use different ways to try and quantify that injury, and that's through history, observation, and neurocognitive testing.
Mm. Now, the neurocognitive testing, does it need to be done in a specialized center?
It can be. Like one of our clinics, we have neurocognitive testing set up to do it there, but it could be done in a pediatrician's office or a general practitioner's office if they had access to the software to provide that to their patient.
So it's a computer...
Computer-based, web-based...
software.
So that's another tool in understanding the functioning of the brain, something that we can see at that point, at the time of injury, and that we can follow on a repeated basis to watch the brain recover. So it's just another added tool that we use in evaluating concussion.
On the other side of the break, Sean's going to get us moving without bumping our heads. And meantime, consider this. Life is full of knocks and bumps, and sometimes we end up taking some really hard hits, like losing a job, receiving a nasty medical diagnosis, or enduring the breakdown of a close relationship. Other times you can simply feel like a human hamster running on a wheel that spins faster and faster. These challenges can make you feel disoriented and disconnected, a bit like a concussion can do. Whether you've been knocked around a lot or a little, it's vital to take time out to rest and recover. That's why God gave the command to spend one day of every week resting. Notice he didn't suggest it, he commanded it and wrote it with his own finger in stone, making it indelible and permanent. Clearly, he's serious about this. So why not try spending time at home reading a spiritual book, being with loved ones, taking a quiet stroll outdoors, socializing and worshiping with friends and family. The day will fly by, leaving you rejuvenated, refreshed, and revived. This habit is not for God's benefit, it's His gift to you. He knows that by taking a total rest each week, you'll receive physical rest, spiritual fulfillment, and emotional nurture. It doesn't get any better than that. So why not try it? You'll be blessed. Get your partner and get into the swing. Sean's with us again today. Sean, welcome.
How you doing?
Good. What have you got for us? You got some sandbells, huh?
Some sandbells. We're going to get some frustration out today. Well, not that we're frustrated. We're not frustrated.
No, we're cool, calm, collected.
Cool, calm, collected. But if you were, I'm going to teach you some exercise.
Okay.
All right? All right, we're going to do some just standing in place, and I want you to bring your heel right back there. There you go. Kick in place. Dynamic exercises. Shake out the arm. Remember, if you had a stressful day, this is a great way to just relax the body. All right, in 3, 2, and 1, okay? Feet nice and wide, all right? We're gonna come down, both hands are gonna come to that left side or right side. Come up to the middle, opposite side. Come up, breathe, opposite side. One more side, up, and perfect. All right, come up nice and easy. Shake it out. Now, if you did have a stressful day, I like the sand bell because, let's use the 8. I like the sand bell because it is full of sand and it allows you to do some dynamic exercises. Partner exercises, the beauty of it is that you can encourage somebody, okay? So this is great because I'm gonna teach you how to slam. You get to slam.
Really?
Yes.
Show us.
I'm gonna show you
how it's done.
All right, here it is. Weight is here and slam it down. Okay, using the legs, all right? Using your quads, using your glutes, stand back up, okay?
Okay.
Then your partner grabs it, okay? Puts it up behind their head, nice slam. All the way down, yes. Total body, all right? And just, it's invigorating, all right?
It is.
Yes, so go ahead. So while you're doing the slam, or I'm doing the slam, I want you to do a squat jump, okay? You're gonna come here and pop up, okay? Then you wait there for me until I'm finished,
all right? All right.
3, 2, and 1. Use those legs. Come on. Nice slam. There you go. You can slam better than that.
I guess my day wasn't stressful enough.
Come on, give me one more. Come on, give me one more. I want to see an impressive slam. Go. Oh, there it is. There it is. I love it. I love it. That is a great
way. What happens when mice get mad.
Of mice and men, right?
Sorry, you were saying.
What I was saying is, doesn't it feel good?
Yeah.
It does, right? It's just
it
something
does.
About
it really
just,
does.
Just releasing that energy.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the sand bell, all right? So now we're gonna turn this to the side and work the obliques. Think of a rainbow is over my head, because there is, all right? And,
This is the one for mice, remember?
And go with the rainbow and slam. Work in that oblique.
Oops.
Okay? Squat down, pick it up. Opposite side. There it is. But try and get it close to your foot without hitting your foot. Go. All right. Pick it up. Go. Come on, give me one more. Go, go. Give me all you got. There you go. Shake it out. Or throw it. So that is a forward slam with your partner using your quads. All right, both of you.
Mm.
And a rainbow slam.
Right.
All right. You had a long day? This is the one for you.
That's slamming good exercise.
All right, feet nice and wide.
Okay.
And what we're gonna do is a hamstring stretch. Okay, we use a little bit of the hamstring, a little bit of the quad.
Yes.
I want you to bring your chest to your knee, all right? Hands wrapped around your ankle. 3, 2, 1, come down nice and slow, opposite side. Hold that ankle, bring your chest to your knee. The further you can bring your chest to your knee, the more you can get a stretch in your hamstring, okay? Come back to the middle, take a nice deep breath, and blow out as you come up. And there you go.
Great.
That made me work, look at that.
Oh yeah.
That made me work.
You're glowing. Thank you. That's great.
You're very welcome.
So I hope you don't need to slam every day, but that's a good one if you've had a bad day.
Nuts, like almonds and peanuts, are full of healthy antioxidants. But not every almond or peanut on the supermarket shelf has the same antioxidant punch. Most of the nut's antioxidants are found in their outer soft covering. When this is damaged through peeling or blanching, half or more of the antioxidants are lost. Choose raw almonds over blanched and enjoy your peanuts with the brown papery covering intact. Choosing nuts in their natural state is another ageless advantage.
I want to thank you for phoning and sending your questions in. Remember, every question has value, so please keep them coming. Betsy called and asked, is hypertrophic cardiomyopathy reversible, and how do you deal with that? Well, unfortunately it's not, but do everything you can to help your heart. So don't smoke, don't drink, don't use drugs, keep your weight down, get plenty of sleep and rest, and manage stress well. Control any diabetes or hypertension that you might have, maintain physical fitness, and see your cardiologist regularly. In terms of food, be sure that you have a good plant-based diet because that will be anti-inflammatory. Nikki emailed and said, following multiple courses of antibiotics for throat infections, I got folliculitis on my skin. That was treated with antibiotics and steroids. And then I got a fungal infection of the nail. That was treated with an antifungal. The throat and nails are better, but the folliculitis is still a problem. What can I do? Well, antibiotics do change the bacterial flora in the body, and it sounds like that may have triggered an alteration in the pH and the bacterial flora of your skin. Then the steroids suppressed your immune system, which triggered the fungal infection of the nails. So it's been a bit of a vicious cycle for you. Now that you've passed the need for antibiotics, take a good quality probiotic for at least a month. Avoid shaving the areas that have the folliculitis with a razor. Instead, if you want to remove hair, use a cream. And for the folliculitis, it may be caused by some type of infection. Put a few drops of tea tree oil or manuka oil in a shallow bath and soak it at least once or twice a week. Someone else called and asked, I have Graves' disease treated with radioactive iodine. Is it possible to get off thyroxine? No, unfortunately, Graves is an immune disease that stimulates the overproduction of thyroid hormones. And once the thyroid has been destroyed by the radioactive iodine, it will no longer function. So to remain healthy, you do need to use thyroxine. It's just like a diabetic needing to use insulin. Mary posted, what juicing machine would you recommend? Can you give me two or three brands? Well, you could use an Omega, Breville's cheaper, the Champion is also more expensive, like the Omega. It all depends on your budget and what you want to do with it. The Champion and others like it also allow you to make ice cream and nut butters. So while you pay more at the front, you actually have more versatility and it will last longer. Thanks for those questions. Remember, you can phone, email, text or Facebook me. And now it's time to go shopping. Modern beetroots are derived from wild sea beets that originated around the coasts of Europe, Middle East and Africa. They're available all year round, so it's easy to find them fresh. Choose fresh, bright, firm textured roots. The top greens should be used while they're fresh. Chop them finely and steam them on their own or with your favourite greens. The root can be kept in the fridge for weeks. They're a wonderful source of iron and nitrate. They boost the immune system and guard against cancer. Beets can be grated and eaten raw, or you can boil, steam, roast, or sauté them. Raw, they're great for juicing, and recent research shows that the juice can bring down high blood pressure. Bon appetit. Today's guests both work at Head First, a specialised centre dealing with sports injury and concussions. Now, let's say your child takes a fall at school that you think could have resulted in concussion. Where should you take them for an acute evaluation? I put that question to Dr. Coleman.
Well, clearly that child hopefully has a pediatrician, and that's the first place to start because that pediatrician has a relationship with the family, knows the child very well. There are changes in behavior and lifestyle that the child may have undergone that pediatrician would know very well. So I think the pediatrician or the primary care physician or the family physician is the first place to start. Now, clearly, if the mechanism of injury has been very significant and the child is significantly injured, clearly going to the nearest emergency room is the place to go.
Right. How do you quantify a concussion then? You're saying if it's a significant, you know, that the history suggests it's significant, or if it's a mild, something that's milder. How do you quantify that when you're assessing?
Well, as Dr. Coleman mentioned, each case is different, and it's a clinical decision. It might be a clinical decision on the field by an athletic trainer. So let's use an example. Let's say a child gets injured in a rugby game or a football game at 9 or 10 o'clock at night. The athletic trainer does an evaluation. There's no neck involvement. The child's still conscious, wasn't knocked unconscious. But clearly, from everybody, they can see they're wobbly, they're dazed, they're disoriented. They can't remember the last couple plays that occurred. So child comes off the field, the coach is like, hey, probably had a concussion, let's keep him off the field. So a good decision made there. Athletic trainer says, hey, don't go back in. And so mom and dad are still worried. The game's finished, it's 10 o'clock at night, so where do we go? Do we need to go to the emergency room or can we go to an urgent care clinic? So I would at least suggest going to an urgent care clinic where they can see medical provider to do an evaluation. And that provider will look at history, observation, and neurocognitive testing to quantify that concussion. They'll use the history to kind of go through those four groups of symptoms that I mentioned, physical, cognitive, emotional, and sleep. They'll do a special subcortical exam to quantify subcortical functioning, and then the neurocognitive piece to quantify that piece. And that together will give the medical provider information on whether the child has a concussion or not.
Now, I'm sure many parents request some kind of scan, a CT, an MRI, or something like that. What do you tell them?
What we tell them is that the scan is really used in very special circumstances, and the scan shows issues, whether it's bleeding into the skull. And we're doing a neurologic exam, taking a history, to really try to understand how sick is this child. Is there actually bleeding into the skull? Is there increased intracranial pressure? And if there's an absence of that, and there's no real evidence of focal lateralizing neurologic findings that would suggest that, then we reassure the parent that there's not a need for the CT scan. And the CT scan is not without risk. I mean, we're always weighing a risk-benefit in terms of any test that we do that involves radiation. And if there's no need for the CT scan, we really try to reassure the parents that there is not evidence of that kind of damage to the brain.
Now, what initial treatment is helpful if we take the same scenario?
Mm-hmm. So let's take the same scenario. Child comes in. It has a number of symptoms, headache, let's say nausea, vomited once, is tired, wants to go to sleep. And the focal neurological exam indicates no lateralization, no focal findings, no need for the CT. Then the medical provider will walk the parents and the child through total brain rest, which is complete stopping of physical activity, complete stopping cognitive activity, no texting, no computer, no fun teenage stuff, in a dark room, resting for the next 48 to 96 hours. No school, take the next couple days off.
Well, that's a good thing.
Absolutely.
The rest of it didn't sound very good to a teenager.
To teenagers that are pretty active in the modern world, they don't enjoy those terms so much.
It sounds pretty difficult to do, but we really try to educate them that it's the important thing to do, that this is a metabolic disorder, it is a metabolic injury to the brain, that it is reducing the metabolic reserve of the brain. So we don't want that brain to be overstimulated by anything that has a display like a TV or a computer or a video game or even a smartphone that's used in texting. So as a result, we really try to let families know that this is the time for the brain to rest. This is the time for the brain to recover.
And so can they read? Can they read books?
We really try to limit that at first.
Really?
I mean,
mm-hmm.
because reading requires a lot of metabolic activity by the brain. And so we want to have the brain devote all of that metabolic activity towards recovery and mm-hmm. towards healing.
And oftentimes in a concussion, you can have ocular motor involvement and their convergence can be off. And it could take some time to get back.
Before so their eyes can focus.
You're actually straining those muscles to try and read. So the cognitive rest is there.
So it's actually a very interesting time for the family and for the child. I mean, this is a time when they are really learning about concussion and going through the time and the effort of resting the brain and allowing it to recover.
After the break, we're talking more about the treatment for a concussion and how to assess recovery. So don't go away. Before the break, our expert guests were talking about 48 to 96 hours of total brain rest following concussion. Here's a typical scenario of what that might look like from HALCAST. Watch.
How to treat a concussion. While the majority of patients suffering concussions can get through it with minor treatment, some cases are serious and need immediate attention. You can learn how to treat a concussion and avoid potentially serious injury later on. You will need symptoms, medical attention, acetaminophen, a neuropsychological evaluation, and rest. Step 1. Identify the symptoms of a concussion. A concussion is any disturbance in brain function and is almost always caused by trauma or injury that causes the brain to be knocked around inside the skull. The most common symptoms are confusion and amnesia. Symptoms also include loss of consciousness, slurred speech, lightheadedness, blurred vision, ringing ears, balance or coordination problems, and nausea. Step 2. Seek immediate medical attention if symptoms are severe, such as unconsciousness, severe or worsening headaches, or persistent vomiting. Someone who is experiencing such symptoms should go to an emergency room for a CT scan. Step 3. Administer acetaminophen to ease head pain, but avoid aspirin, ibuprofen, and other non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, which may increase the risk of bleeding. Step 4. Avoid sports if you're an athlete and refrain from any vigorous activity for as long as symptoms persist. Ask a doctor when it's safe to resume play. Symptoms may persist for a few days to a few weeks, and until they subside, further head trauma can result in permanent damage. Step 5. Look for post-concussive syndrome, the symptoms of which include memory loss, judgment and concentration difficulties, and balance or coordination problems. If such symptoms persist, seek a neuropsychological evaluation. Step 6. Stay home, rest, and wait it out. While extreme cases are rare, most symptoms of mild concussions will go away in a matter of days, and you'll be able to resume your normal routine. Did you know? An estimated 1.1 million people in the United States suffer a concussion each year.
Now that's almost an epidemic. So after taking 2 to 4 days of complete brain rest, Dr. Coleman explains what happens next.
That first period of complete brain rest is just the beginning. The recovery period then is really protocolized going forward. And we really try to be very careful not to overstimulate the brain, but get that patient back to their normal activities. We start with cognitive activities first, then we add the physical activities later. So there are, for children in school, there are cognitive protocols called return to learn that are very carefully designed to gradually add more cognitive activity, where the children are demonstrating that they can perform a certain stage of cognitive activity without return of their symptoms. And we have a number, about 5 or 6 stages that they go to that are progressive, that are being supervised by a professional, educational and healthcare professional in the school setting. Once they have successfully completed that return to learn, which is very well protocolized, then we begin a return to play. And the return to play is the same concept, that they are progressively adding more and more physical activity, demonstrating that the brain can withstand that added stimulus without return of their symptoms. After they've completed that return to play, and we find that their physical exam is normal, their neurologic exam is normal, their subcortical exam that Dr. Dorn mentioned is normal, that they're able to go through the return to learn, go through the return to play, then we're at the point then of medical clearance, at really seeing that they have recovered. And that varies from patient to patient. It may take a patient 2 weeks to get through it. Some patients, it takes a little bit longer. But it's very progressive, very organized, and very by protocol, really trying to understand how the brain is recovering and not putting the patient at further risk.
Right. So, Dr. Doran, what can alter the rate of recovery? Are there comorbidities? Are there things that can alter how quickly a person
sure.
can recover?
Sure. Some of them we've mentioned already. If somebody's experienced a concussion and then experiences a concussion right after that. So we know multiple concussions is going to slow recovery. Other comorbid conditions that can affect recovery are anxiety and depression, emotional disorders. If a child's suffering from attention deficit disorder or learning disabilities, that can affect recovery as well.
We found that patients with chronic headache disorders or even migraine or have a family history of migraine, that they sometimes have a more protracted recovery. So that's information that we try to get right up front when we first meet the patient to get an understanding of those comorbid conditions that might make their recovery a little longer than other patients. Mm.
And you mentioned old school, like 5, 10 years ago, we would say, hey, stay out of school for a week, you know, stay off the playing field for 10 days. What we're finding now is that recovery can take, you know, weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks. It's fairly common for teenage boys and girls.
And I guess that makes sense because we know that nerves don't recover as quickly as say, skin wounds or organ damage.
And that's an important point because you can see a sprained ankle recover and you can see other injuries recover. But sometimes as the brain is recovering or even as the brain is injured, as you asked initially, you don't see the injury. So as a result, it's a very important concept of educating the parents, really educating the player, the student, of how their brain is recovering, what's happening to them metabolically, and taking it with a greater degree of seriousness.
Now, if during the recovery process you test them and you find that they they've say return to learn, but they've now got symptoms back again. What do you do at that point?
You would continue to treat them. It's quite common that a child's not complaining of symptoms. So that piece is done. Their subcortical exam is fine. But then we do the neurocognitive testing piece, and we find that they're still not functioning. Their reaction time, their verbal memory, their visual memory isn't quite up to speed. So the child doesn't even know that they're struggling. The parent doesn't even realize that, hey, the child's struggling. So that neurocognitive piece is important in helping us continue to treat the child and let them know, hey, even though you're not experiencing symptoms, you still have a bit of recovery to do yet.
And there are other modes of therapy for some of those patients who are having longer periods of symptoms. Based on what those symptoms are and what our findings are in doing their physical exam and their neurologic exam, there are medications that we use. Some patients actually have injury to the neck during their first mechanism of injury that contributes to their headache and to the progression of their symptoms. And we oftentimes use a neck collar to protect their neck and to offer really relief to some of the structures in the brain that are related to injuries in the neck. As Dr. Doran mentioned, some of the patients have oculomotor findings. So we find that physical therapy, oculomotor therapy, is very useful in those patients who are having protracted recovery.
What sort of medications do you use?
There are a variety of different medications that are used for sleep difficulties. Melatonin and trazodone can be used for emotional difficulties. The SSRI, Zoloft, Prozac.
Those are just used temporarily, the antidepressant type medications?
It depends. Again, it's a clinical decision. Each individual, each brain is different. Certainly with individuals that come to us with a previous history of depression, a previous history of anxiety, what we find is those individuals probably go on the medication a little quicker, probably stay on the medication a little longer. Individuals that have never had that history, but one of their primary symptoms that they're experiencing are emotional difficulties, depression, or irritability, they might go on the medication and stay on it a little bit shorter.
Mm. So I think the critical point is that each patient is different, and the therapy has to be individualized based on that patient's findings, their history, what symptoms are that they're having, how long they're lasting. We sometimes employ the use of neurologists. Sometimes we use psychologists. Sometimes we use oculotherapists, physical therapists. So it's really individualized based on each patient's situation.
Now, let's just talk a little bit for the last minute about prevention. Are there exercises that people can do players can do to help prevent concussion or limit the effects of it? Are helmets good?
If I were recommended to a parent, I have three kids that have competed up to college athletics, so I would definitely encourage parents to, hey, have your kids play sports. There's so many learning opportunities in terms of leadership, discipline, teamwork. But in terms of prevention, I would tell those same parents and kids, get in the best physical shape that you can possibly be in. And if you're in the best physical shape, your neck and supporting apparatus is going to be that much better to withstand a hit as best you can.
I think education and awareness is the best prevention. I think student athletes, their coaches, their trainers, parents, even healthcare professionals need to be educated about concussion, about the symptoms, about the risk, and we need to change some of the orientation that athletes have towards playing hurt. So I think the greatest prevention is education and awareness.
Well, thank you so much. We've run out of time. It's been great having you on the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Watch out for accidents that could cause concussion or shake the brain. Take note of any slurred speech, dizziness, visual changes, lack of balance and coordination, or nausea following the injury. If you have any of those symptoms, then do not play on. Instead, seek medical attention and follow the advice of the experts, even if it does involve complete brain rest for up to 4 days. It may seem long, but remember Tracy? Don't compound the injury and you'll recover quicker. Look for post-concussion syndrome, loss of memory, concentration, balance, and coordination. If those things are not going away, then you need a full neuropsychological evaluation and ongoing care from a specialty center like Head First. And as ever, prevention should always be your focus. Choose wisely what sport you encourage your kids and grandkids to play. Former NFL player and head coach Duffy Doherty once said, "Football is not a contact sport, it's a collision sport. Dancing is a contact sport." Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you next time.